The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Bizarre.
Bazan. Bazan. Bazan.
Bazan. Bazan. Bazan. Bazan. Bazan.
This is Bazan, the bizarre and weird a fiction podcast with me, your host, Mr. Frank. Zongers, I hope you've all recovered from the big 100th episode event spectacular celebration of Bazan, because I'm not letting up on you. We're jumping right back into the fray, giving the episode 101, although really, I'm done counting now. Mr. Frank's had it enough with counting until we get closer to like 200 or wherever we're going to celebrate again. But I really do appreciate everybody who called in and helped out with the spectacular. You all made that such a wonderful show. I just had so much fun. Probably one of the most funnest episodes I ever had putting together. So thank you, everybody who was able to call in and participate. And if you weren't, hey, we'll probably do it again for episode 200. But we got a long way to go before we get there. We got to start here at episode 101, Zongers. And we can't start episode 101 unless we acknowledge the wonderful sponsors of Bazong and the Project Entertainment Network. I, of course, am talking about Subculture Courses and Clothing, Zongers. Visit them in Jacksonville, Florida, at the Avenues Mall. Or if you're not in that area, you can always visit them on the intertubes at www.subculturecourses.com. There you will find the best in rockabilly, pinup, steampunk, goth, and of course, uber awesome corsets, Zongers. Shop until you drop over there, because the fine folks at Subculture Corsets scan the globe for the finest in those clothing categories to bring them back to you so you can look your best when you're out and about on the night on your town, Zongers. And I'm going to help you save a little extra cashish, a little more jingle when you shop at Subculture Courses so you can go out and look your best. You're going to fill up your cart, Zongers, because it's not just one item. I'm going to give you 10% off your entire order, Zongers. All you have to do is enter the promotional code BAZONG at checkout, and you'll receive 10% off your entire order, Zongers. And if you happen to shop in-store, just do the same thing. When you're checking out at the counter and you go up and you see Carlisle or Mrs. Han or Mr. Han, whoever happens to be manning the register that day, you just yell at them, Bazong! And they'll probably get a little concerned, and you may need to explain to them, well, Bazong is the premier podcast on the Project Entertainment Network. How dare you not know that? And they will go, yes, of course, Bazong. We try not to acknowledge them because they're so weird. So thank you, Subculture Courses, for sponsoring this show and allowing us to be weird and giving us 10% off your fine clothing. Subculturecourses.com. And Zonger, we move forward this week. Another fine guest, another first-time guest to the show, and another guest from across the globe. The other side of the Atlantic Ocean from where I am anyway. Unless you're listening from that side of the ocean, then I'm on the other side of the ocean. It's all very confusing, but what I'm saying is that our next guest is all the way from Brighton, UK. Repping for the UK, repping for Brighton. Wonderful accents. I love accent songers, so had to have our next guest, Mr. Zach Ferguson, on to discuss his brand of Bizarro. He's crafting sort of a new brand of Bizarro over there. He's got his new publishing company that he's working with, called Nihilism Revised, and he's just trying to do his thing. He's doing some spectacular work, as you're all about to find out. So, hey, let's just dive in to the Bazong interview of the Cockney wonderfulness of Mr. Zach Ferguson. Give us the gong. I'd like to welcome to Bazong this week a guy who's, and to me, looks like he's burst onto the scene within the past 6 months. He's just out and about all around doing all kinds of stuff. I definitely had to take a chance, this opportunity to bring him on the show, and he's got that sexy, sexy accent that Mr. Frank loves so much. So let's welcome to Bazong all the way from Brighton, UK, Mr. Zach Ferguson. Zach, welcome to Bazong.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, Zach. Like I said, and in case anybody hasn't heard, you're from across the pond, as it were, unless you're on that
side. Yes, I am.
Unless you're listening from that side of the pond, then I'm across the pond.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people get confused anyway from my area. There's a whole selection of accents. So you could come up to someone, you're like, yeah, I'm homegrown. I'm from Brighton. And they're like, what? No, you're not. You're from London. Or are you sure you haven't got a bit of American in you? They're all a bit backwards in my town.
Now, I don't have all the you know, I've watched My Fair Lady. I know there's all those distinct accents over there in the UK. But, and I could be off here. But would your accent best be described as Cockney?
Yeah, this is the thing. I am from the Sussex area, which is, we are very close to being the cultured Cockneys. But because we're so in our area, we've got this pride. We're Brightonians. So if anything, we do share a lot with the Cockney, with the London East End, but we've kind of folded it in our southern graces, different little like slips of the tongue, and that just, it sets us out from the rest.
My God, I love it. See that? I'm Henry Higgins, man. I picked it up. Yeah, no, I was almost there. I was just a little bit off on that, but I love that Cockney accent. Like when, I mean, you know, of course he's not really British, but when Austin Powers does the whole Cockney thing and that Cockney gibberish, the pork pies and the chop chops, and I just love it.
Yeah.
I have no idea what's going on, but I love every second of it. So if you threw a little in, I wouldn't be offended.
I might slip in a few, you know, slang terminologies or something that's probably gibberish. But in my mind's eye, that's what being British is.
Now, let's talk about being British, because you are the cradle of the English language over there. So you have to be writing it correctly. Another reason why I defer to you as the writer, you're obviously an expert from over there, the home of Shakespeare. Let's talk about what's a bizarro to you over in the land of Shakespeare.
Oh, God. Well, for what I know, Shakespeare could have been into bizarro, because we don't really know who Shakespeare was, do we? Not really. He could have been the originator of it, because, you know, half of his dialogue is absolute tosh. Doesn't make any sense. So when people do come over here like, oh, Shakespeare, yes, oh, to be, oh, they, oh, well, oh, well, you're just like, huh? No, I don't read that. Everyone thinks that's textbook English. But no, from my end, when it comes to bizarro, from the British perspective, it comes in the form of a very few British authors who, you know, commercially, they can't really say, oh, my work is bizarro. They probably don't even know that, what bizarro stands for. But I pick out a selection of authors, great, old, new, like William S. Burroughs. There is so much going on within his work that is bizarro infused. J.G. Ballard, Terry Pratchett, Neil Gaiman. So there's always been that sensibility of something off kilter. And that's where I come from, really. I've always written things that were not of the norm. And it wasn't only until I met Lisa Cantoral that she introduced me to bizarro.
Is that right? That you? So you're writing this stuff, you know, you're writing, period, before meeting Lisa and before being brought to bizarro. What is it that are you writing a bizarro and not realizing it before you get introduced?
Yes, that is exactly it, because what I'd been doing was I'd been writing a various selection of projects. And because I have a friend called Peter James, he's like a big crime novelist out here, like very successful. And I'd send him all of my short stories and my weird half, you know, I've got a project, I've got a book, but honestly, it's literally two pages. And I'd send them along to him, and he would graciously, though he shouldn't have, he gave me agents, contact numbers and emails. And for at least 4 or 5 years before I understood that there is, you know, there is policy, there is some composure that needs to be made when sending out submissions, I'll just throw out all this crazy shit, like a decapitated hand wanking someone off to death to a bloody publisher who would publish like established people, like a like a Ramsey Campbell type, you know, like mm-hmm. I was going to the wrong, just to the wrong people and at the wrong time. I was so young, and when I was introduced to what is overall the small press, I'd been writing such bizarre, jagged things, and I was so disheartened, because these big publishers, these big agents were not giving me the time of day. And when I met Lisa Cantoral and I described to her a short story I was writing at the time called The Rumpin' Wrist, which is the the one about the severed hand that would go around wanking people to death. And then there's also a story about a man who was decapitated and he has a penis spouting from his neck. It was pure bizarro, but I didn't know what that meant. So when she said, "Oh my God, dude," she said, "that is pure bizarro." She said, "You are going to be right at home with us." And that was what introduced me. And then she told me to read Kevin L. Donaghy, and my mind exploded. I was like, I have a home. Oh my God, brothers and sisters. Yay!
That's so often the story. Easily 90% of the story that everybody comes to Bizarro. It's they're already writing it in some form, shape, or form. And, you know, either they stumble upon it just looking on Amazon, or they have mm-hmm. somebody who recognizes what it is. And then points go, look, this is what you're writing. And bang, the door's open. Now, how long ago did this happen? You're talking to Lisa.
This was... I'd been rummaging around the UK horror scene, and I was given the opportunity to publish a short story in an anthology called Chromatics. And I was mediating my writing. It wasn't true to me. What happened was I started putting myself in a box. I was conforming myself to these, even though it wasn't a literary rule, I made myself believe there was a strict literary rule when it came to horror and everything else that comes with it. All these different avenues were blocked off like a barricade. And just with the realization that I could go out there and write something that is like just bonkers, it's saturated with everything that I love, the perverse, the surreal, the socio-politically driven, the irrelevancy. The reason that I've been an outsider all my life is I have all these stories in my head. I'm this strange, odd-bod individual out here over on this side of the world. And no one's connected with my work. And then to have Lisa basically say, "Oh my God, dude, you're an..." like for a heck of a treat meeting these people. It was rather beautiful. And what happened was it didn't really open up doors publication wise because it took up to almost 2 years to get my first official book released. But what it did was it allowed me to have a freedom as a writer to say, I'm not going to conform to these rules. And then as I've grown and I've realized that there are certain outlooks in Bizarro where there is a rule to it, it still just, it opened me out in such a way. It made me discover that you can do anything and everything within reason.
Yeah. And even like you said, even if you're not directly publishing to Bizarro, you still, that untethered, that sense of freedom, that nothing matters. There's no rules holding you back anymore.
Well, exactly. And the world of Bizarro opened up my exploration of Bizarro Pope Press, who do a lot of transgressive novels. And yeah. Transgressive is my bag. And there's a lot of experimentalism in Bizarro. Though many people like to naysay and go, no, there isn't. There's no home for experimentalism. Yes, there is. The whole encapsulation of Bizarro is the experimental, because you are playing against, let's say, type. You're playing against the literary rule. You're playing against the constructs that have been put before. This isn't normal. We can't publish it. And it just made me, you know, get in contact with such inspirational writers like Jordan Crowell and Chris Kelso and Seb Dalbinsky. And now my business partner and stroke publisher, S.C. Burke, who really opened my eyes to transgressive fiction and experimental fiction to such an extent that all these Bizarro presses were willing to publish experimental works, even if your work wasn't full on. You know, all the attributes of Bizarro, even if you had a little shred of it, these publication houses were open. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't naysay you. And that's where Eat Your Keyboard came from. It was my first debut novel. It's an experimental one, but it is very infused with what you would, you know, class as Bizarro.
Yeah, of course. And that's another wonderful thing. Like, you have those publishers out there, like you said, Bizarro Pulp Press, stuff like Addle and Grindhouse comes to mind. They're not publishing those straight Bizarro books. They're not necessarily Bizarro publishers per se. But
no,
man,
and you can't label it. Cannot label it, not at all, because there's so much within. There's so many avenues. It opens up so much more, and it's really difficult. But with Bizarro has ushered in is... there is a name for this type of melee of, you know, great works, transgressive, experimental, prose, poetic, poetry. It's just, it boggles my mind that these presses encapsulate so much that the commercial don't. But you know what? It doesn't need to be, because that's what makes it wholesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And cumbersome. You're comforted by it.
Now, the other thing you were saying, too, is you were sort of slogging around in the UK horror scene, trying to find your people, almost. And now, like, you said you found Bizarro, and then, bang, you dropped this list of, you know, really awesome names in the scene, whether they're Bizarro or not. They're connected. They're connected to Bizarro. A lot of them U.S. names, and, of course, you come to Lisa. She's on this side of the pond. Did it make it easier or like suddenly open doors? Because I know there's a lot of Bizarro representation on your side of the ocean.
Well, the thing is, I think the representation of Bizarro on our side of things, it's become a bit one-sided now. People are taking it upon themselves to say, and on the other side of the pond where it generated, a lot of the Portland scene believe that because they were there at the genesis of it, this is how it is, that is how it is. That's not progression. That's not the encapsulation of what I believe Bizarro is. Who are you to tell me that Eat Your Keyboard isn't Bizarro? Because it has elements in there that you can't quite put your finger on. So hence, it's Bizarro. It's weird fiction. But if anything, it is experimentalism, and most of my work does veer into the experimentalism territory. But my latest release, Mr. Nick, is a fantasy. But it's linear, and it is pure Bizarro, but with a very, very British tinge. It's extremely... I feel like... I know it sounds really pretentious and bold of me, and I know Chris Kelso, though he's on this side of the pond, but he's not really British. He's Scottish. He's up there, isn't he? He's away from us. I think I've really introduced a British etiquette when it comes to the Bizarro genre. Like, I know we've got Madeline Swan, but I feel like a lot of these writers who are British and are Bizarro authors, they kind of structure it around the American ideologies and the American politics. And, you know, that's brilliant. Yeah, I'm not discounting that, but I feel that it just, Mr. Nick has this irrelevancy, this Monty Python edge, this Terry Gilliam whimsy that I feel Bizarro is lacking when it comes to a certain, you know, cultural viewing. So I'd like to say Mr. Nick is the first official British Bizarro. May not be, but that's how I view it as me, as an author and as a creator from that angle of things.
That's a great point to bring up, too. I hadn't thought about it too much. The sort of, that, like you brought up, the Monty Python of Bizarro. I guess it is sort of lacking in the scene, but for me... I mean, I remember growing up as a kid and Benny Hill would be on and Monty Python and I just couldn't wrap my head around it. And it was, I mean, it was really just bonkers because it was so alien to me, that type of humor. And, you know, mm-hmm. it's coming from a different place. And I mean, it wasn't until probably my 20s where all of a sudden a movie I'd seen on and off in bits and spurts, The Holy Grail, it just all of a sudden it made sense to me. And, you know, that may or may not do with drug use I was having at the time. But all of a sudden, it was like, this is hilarious. I mean, right from those credits with the llamas and all that shit and the sacking of the writer, all of a sudden, it was brilliant. And all of a sudden, it was like, I don't know what it was, just a maturity or something that came over me. And all of a sudden, all this British humor I found just absolutely brilliant. And I never got it before. And I don't know what happened, but the light went off. So you're really feeling like... there's a distinct British Bizarro voice sort of forming and maybe possibly forming with you.
Yes, yes. You put it beautifully there, because Monty Python, the inclusion of Terry Jones, all the greats, they were doing something with television back then where there was literally four channels, and you know, mm-hmm. the producers, the execs, they're a bit shy of what to put on and what not to put on. But it seemed to connect in a really universal way, greater than even the TV execs who controlled the broadcasts. You know what I mean? They were like, oh my God, something is off about this, but it universally like ties us together. It's the same with Aardman Animation, their earliest series like Rex the Runt. All of their works are off. It's just peculiarity, irrelevancy, but with a smorgasbord of different tastes, political, satire, transgressive, the humour for the kids. And though Monty Python wasn't for children, there was something inherently zany that the children could enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, the one I always think about is The Meaning of Life. I was probably maybe 8 or 9. We rented it on a VHS cassette and watched it, and I had no idea what the heck was going on. And I shouldn't have any idea as an 8-year-old what's going on. But, you know, at the end there, you get to that guy barfing, and that's just child is wonderful. And it was disgusting, and you know, there was something childishly appealing to it. And I think probably what it is. You know, it does look like a childish humor type of thing, but when you reach your 20s, it's the adult humor aspect, the thing that clicks. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, all of that makes sense. You know, whereas a kid, it's not really something really meant for kids, like you said.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like watching it as a child, you knew something wasn't quite right. You knew that you weren't getting something that you're because I watched them with my grandparents at the ripe old age of 4 years old. And I remember my grandfather just slapping his knee, chortling, "Oh, this is fucking brilliant." And I'm just looking at him like, yeah, it's funny because granddad likes it. And because of that reaction, that engagement, growing up, I would go to the VHS tapes. They were in a cardboard slipcase, 3 of them, the trilogy. And I would keep going back and I would keep studying them. And like that type of humor, it became who I am and who I was as a person. But it wasn't only, as you've mentioned, as you mature, it strengthens something in you in a fibrous fashion. It solidifies you into the person you were. So Monty Python, in my opinion, is the quintessential bizarro British take on things. It's so wondrous. And even Terry Gilliam, though he is an American filmmaker, he's been over here since the 60s. I think he has a British citizen card. So a lot of his movies are inherently a fusion of European aesthetics, but bohemian, like, craziness, surrealism. And his sense of humour is inherently British, and it's just those types of things. And as you mature, it binds into you. Like I remember in The Meaning of Life, where I think it was Eric Idle's character, he's telling you to follow him, and you're going on this great adventure through the fields away from the restaurant, and he's showing you this vista of a field, and he's telling you about his home life, and then at the end, okay, now fuck off, just fuck off, now fuck off. It's just, it's ridiculous, it makes no sense, but that's why it's funny. That's why it's universally appealing. Oddities, strangeness of character, it's open-mindedness. It shows where you come from. And a lot of people within the bizarro world are open-minded, willing to learn new things, willing to laugh at something they might not have, willing to encapsulate the weird. And it's just a conglomeration of imagination, power and intellect. And all this bullshit about, oh, they're lefties, or this person's righties. It's about the art. It's about these artists together achieving the utmost end goal, to tell stories, to create and to like craft a tapestry that is going to live on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's such, I mean, sometimes when I watch some of even like the Flying Circus skits, they're completely goofy, but you sit there and you're like, this is absolutely brilliant, like the intelligence. it strikes you in that way, you know, like the dead parrot thing, and they're sitting there arguing about it. But it seems like goofy, but man, the intelligence and to hone in on something so simple like that and to make it work and be hysterical, it's you know, it's like what Harvard's doing with National Lampoon. It's just beyond to construct that, and man, that's what I mean when I write. I'm sort of always going for that sort of a joke, you know. It looks like the lowest common denominator type joke, but I really want there to be a sort of a little bit of brains behind all that cheap shot of a dick joke or something, you know?
Exactly, and that there's a great distinction with current bizarro books and trends. I'm not going to say anyone in particular because I really couldn't do it because there are so many. But if you sprinkle, you sprinkle a little bit of something, and if that joke can pay off let's say this joke is introduced on page 5, and then the payoff is on page 100, and that person laughs at it, you've won. You've won. The book works for you, whether or not it's subjectively funny or not. It's a case of taking something, and if it works for the scene or the characters or just the overall aesthetic, do it. Like, there's a lot of petulant sequences in Eat Your Keyboard because it's a cut-up method style book where it's segmentations. There's an overall thread of narrative, but at the same time, there really isn't. I didn't know what the fuck I was writing. All I knew was what I was putting on the page made me laugh, and it was hitting on topics at the time that I felt were relevant to me as a person and maybe as a whole to the literary world specifically, because when I'm writing, my thought doesn't really reach past the community. And I think that recently that's where I've been cutting ties, maybe speaking up a bit when I shouldn't have, or being voicing opinions in ways that people find pretentious or a bit domineering or a bit hot-headed. But it's that cutoff of realizing I don't want to conform to what everyone else wants to feel or think. And I think that's what the embodiment of Eat Your Keyboard is in my writing. I'm not a dangerous person. I'm not out to hurt anyone. I'm not out to belittle anyone's ideals, but I stick up for those who are oppressed and bullied. And you know what? I'm not a dangerous person, but my fiction is. You know what I mean?
I hear you. Let's dig into your fiction a little bit more than we have. Mr. Nick and Eat Your Keyboard, you've brought up. Now, they're self-published works, correct?
They are self-published, but it's under the banner of Nihilism Revised. It's a Utah-based underground press, and I met Stephen through Facebook, as usual. This is how everything starts, the interconnectivity of Facebook. I bloody love it. And he had this underground press, and I pitched him the idea for Eat Your Keyboard, because there was something with Stephen. We are literally a chip off the old block. We are symbiotically entwined. We are the same. We're cut from the same cloth of the cosmos. We're very enrolled with each other. We're on the same level. And I introduced him to the world of CreateSpace, you know, Lulu.com. And I said, you can open up your avenues as a publisher by using print on demand. And our first real venture out into that world was Eat Your Keyboard. It is most definitely viewed as self-published. It even says it on the bottom, you know, when you scroll down onto Amazon and it goes CreateSpace self-publication, and we're kind of like, no, it's not, because there's a taboo around that, and there really shouldn't be, because there are masterful self-published books out there, some that aren't. But if anything, when we do say we release our works, it's under the NR label. And since the introduction of POD to Stephen, we've branched out within the year exponentially. My role with him has gone beyond being one of his authors. I'm now working as a novice publisher myself. We've just released our first official anthology called Strange Behaviors, an anthology of absolute luridity. And we're just expanding, man, you know. And it's like, we want to create a press that maybe people like. We've already set a distinctive tone with our covers, that black and white punk rock feel, and already people are coming to us going, oh, just by looking at that cover, that's NR. And that's what we want to build it up to. We want to build it up to, we are publishers. We're not just people playing at being publishers, you know. We're not people who are self-publishing and then making out we're bigger than we actually are. We are what we are. We work out of the confines of the certain pit that other people do. But yeah, it is under Nihilism Revised, but, you know, I'm not bullshitting anyone. I'm not deluding anyone. Every small press is, you know, self-published. That's it. That's reality.
It's beautiful. And I see, and I thank you for clarifying, because I did notice that you have the Nihilism Revised publishing company, or whatever you want to call an imprint. Yeah, I wasn't sure how that was working, but you're sort of building. It sounds like you're building your brand of bizarro sort of fiction.
Yes, that's it. That's it. What we say at NR is, though we are really for the transgressive, we are really for the experimental, we are bizarro. We are within that. But like we said earlier, you can't really just put it under one thing. There are enough bizarro elements that we are part of that world, but we like to see ourselves on the fringes. We're the place that if you go to one publication house or another and they've blindsided you, or they've not approached or treated your work the way you wanted, come to us. We are here to nurture you, to help you, All of my proceeds of Eat Your Keyboard haven't gone towards me. I said from the start, all my experimental works goes back to the press to pay for the authors for future endeavours. And that can be said. We recently, with recent publication, our anthology, Strange Behaviours, we got Jim Agpolza to do the cover, an original piece, which is fucking beautiful. And then Stephen on the side decided that we're going to do a limited edition run, seeing all these vast arrays of beautiful illustrations and sensual anarchic chaos from the mind and from the tip of Jim's creative pen. And oh, if that sounded a bit rude, anyway. And we're using our money from it to give people a chance that, you know, no one gave us. Give people the chance that Stephen gave me. Stephen saved at least $3,000 to publish Eat Your Keyboard locally, to have it bound and printed. And that showed his dedication. That's how he'd been doing it from the start. And I said, look, economically and the way things are growing now in the press, maybe come out of the basement a bit and move into the living room, per se. You know what I mean? Move into the living room. You see, POD, economically, you can sustain it. You really can. I know a lot of people have gone down under, but it's just the way you treat your authors and treat your finances, and it's a juggling act. And we've pushed out with Eat Your Keyboard, The Weird, Long Way to Richmond, Donald Armfield's recent chapbook release, which is the great, it's a re-release, it's a great Green Tea Heist, and now with Mr. Nick and the anthology, we're pushing out. We want to create a name for ourselves. We want to be part of your world, but at the same time, we don't. It doesn't, it's not like we're afraid. It's not like we don't want to be associated, because everyone in our anthology is from bizarro roots. We've got Emma MP Johnson, for God's sake. I was so happy when she submitted. We have Jean-Claude Smith. Jean-Claude Smith. Love that name. We have so many people from that world willing to go, you know what, we want to experiment ourselves, we want to push ourselves, we don't want to truncate ourselves, we want to become part of your world, because what we represent, it is a danger. It is a danger of progression. I think there's a great complacency within the bizarro world, not in a negative light, where there's a strict regime, a strict manner. You can't do that, because you're not going to grow as a genre or as artists if you think like that.
I the names, I mean, I'm looking at, you know, who you have listed here for Strange Behaviors, and two things pop out of me. I mean, I'll just riff. You got Sam Richard, you got Teresa Braun, Jordan Crawl, Emma Johnson, Nicholas Day, Donald Armfeld, Austin James, Alex Carl Johnson, Charles Austin Muir, Joseph Boothier Jr., Michael Fawn, some dude named Zach Ferguson, Jason Morton, Mike Zirbel. They go on and on. Two things strike me at this. I mean, first, those names collectively do not represent any one sort of bizarro clique. And
no,
it's that sort of different as far as bizarro anthologies go. You notice they're very clicky. And the other thing is, and it's like you say, those names are all over the place as far as the type of writing that they represent. So just looking at the names you've included in the book, yes, you are not sticking to any one sort of thing.
No.
This isn't your batch of friends from the bizarro community. This is a really big cross-section of what's out there bizarro-wise.
Yes, exactly. We wanted, first of all, when I said to Stephen, let's do an anthology, he was like, no. Not yet. I'm like, no, look, let's just go in the deep end and do it, but don't invite authors. There was a couple of authors that we reached out to and said, look, this is open for you. We really think you would, you know, work well within it. And it wasn't until Jim's official cover art came out that people gravitated towards us. What? These small publishers got Jim? These small, oddball experimental artists? That Zach, who's always spewing off and shouting his mouth off, and the quiet Stephen, who just infrequently pops up and makes an appearance? They've got Jim involved? It really helped us to get a little bit of respect, a little of appreciation. It opened their eyes. It opened up their minds a little bit, where they went, oh, they're doing something different. They're willing to push. They're willing to challenge. They're willing to release dangerous works. Like Sam's piece that we featured. I don't know if you've read it or if you know of it, the sad, heart-wrenching passing of his dearly beloved. And his short is based around the therapy, the her ashes, the ingestion of her, being connected to her. And we said to him, man, this is powerful stuff, but are you willing and are you ready for people to read this and potential backlash? And he said, no, I need this. It's therapy and it's kind of closure. That hurt will never go away with him. But that short story featured is the personification of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Stories that emote, stories that come from a dark place, stories that come from within, not a story written on the fly because you want to be beside your friends. Oh, look, I'm next to this person. Oh, I'm next to that person. Yes, there is a truth that some of the authors who did get involved only got involved because they saw their friends involved. But that also gave them and allowed them a moment of introspection. Oh, I shouldn't just be in this because my friends are in it. They're actually doing something really good. And it just, once you are part of NR, you're our family. You are part of us. You are our brethren. Not everyone's on the same wavelength of us, like morality, you know, like a moral compass. Let's look at it like that. Everyone has different views. Everyone has different politics, especially when it comes to publication or being in a book. But we like to think that these people aren't converted, but they are converted to our cult. We're not a dangerous cult. We're not spewing hate, vitriol. But what vitriol and what hate that we do, you know, subjugate our audiences to, it's through our work. It's through our characters. It's through our need to make light of very damning times. Our stories can be about something personal or it can be something that's just there to make you laugh. We're there to just encourage art, artists, making something. You're an artist. Create. Don't subjugate yourself to a certain way of thinking. Be free. Be open. Be part of the cosmos. Be part of the cancer that we are spreading. It's not an evil cancer. It's a cancer of creation. And that's what we're always saying with NR.
I love it. I love it. I mean, I have not read the book, but I'm so intrigued by what you've put together. I definitely something.
Well, me and Stephen will happily send you an NR bundle. We will happily send you all of our works currently.
Oh, that's very generous of you. I appreciate that. There is a thing I did notice. I mean, you're talking about, you know, going from, you know, spending a lot of money and getting professionally bound books and all that to print on demand stuff, but still you're not putting out digital ebook copies. Is what's the yes, decision there?
This we're stubborn bastards. we love the smell and the feel of books. Like, it comes from a place where at the time when we were setting up shop, we are just releasing books. We're not doing this for money. We're not doing this for a quick click or a free, oh, get this free book from this guy whilst you purchase your Kindle or, you know, your ebook. We were very dead set in our ways where we went, no, only books. And then as it progressed, Kindle, inevitably, that's what the be all end all is going to be with publications. We know it. So we basically just wanted to release books. If you're a fan of artistry, you're a fan of the whole product, the whole miasma of what it means to be a published author, there's no feeling, and you know this because you've got your own books out, holding your book, your baby, like your own child, flicking through it, just appreciating it, holding it. You don't get that feeling with Kindle.
No.
But this year, we are going to branch out into the digital matrix that is Kindle.
Yeah.
Because we want to expand our audience, and it feels like we are kind of doing what is detrimental. We want to expand people's horizons with literature. And what better way? Okay, someone buys one book. Oh, get this one book for free, and it could be a Mr. Nick, or, oh, get this book for 99p. Oh, it's Eat Your Keyboard, or Stephen's The Weird. And then they could read that and go, holy fucking shit. Fiction like this exists, much like my attitude towards experiencing Bizarro. all this weird stuff that's like accumulated over the years, it has a name, it has a temple, but who says that temple has to just remain without any scaffolding coming off of it? Who says that we can't put a extension on it? And that's what we're trying to do.
I completely appreciate, you know, the book itself, the physical book as you know, its own piece of art and something to be held and tangible and appreciated. On the same token, I'm a reader with a house that has limited space, so I've always embraced digital ebooks. I mean, the amount of space I have now compared to what I would have had those books been physical. So ebooks are always appealing to me. As a reader, of course. As a writer, I'm sort of dumbfounded that, because I enjoy the ebook format so much, that going out there with my books in front of people, that they buy them so much. I'm like, really? You want that? Okay, here. But I sell actual way more copies, physical copies of my book, than I actually sell of ebooks, which seems to me to fly in the face of common sense, but that's how it works out. But still, I mean, to see what you're putting together here with your anthology and with your own work, it seems to me like you're missing a boat, sort of, not being out there digitally. I mean, my God, the accessibility of that. And like I said, while I appreciate, you know, respecting the book as its own form of art, just the actual work itself, the collection itself of words that you've put together, I think it would be important to make that accessible to as many people as possible.
Yeah, and we are definitely going to take that plunge this year. We definitely are. We kind of got our head out of our asses and out of our own, like, miasma of self-entitlement. But also, it comes down to informational processes. I remember me and Stephen were having a hard time transitioning from doing the books to setting up a alternate account to do a Kindle. It seemed to not be working our ways. And in the face of, you know, a hurdle, we kind of just shot it down, and we're like, we'll come back to you later. We'll finish you off later.
Yeah, I mean, it is almost publishing another book altogether when you do.
Yeah, but the way you just articulated it, it got me just sitting there going, holy shit, I need that talk, that push. We do need that talk. We do need that push. We do need that perspective. And no, it's actually urged me to want to inundate Stephen now with messages of, get us on Kindle.
Yeah, it's always, I like casting a wide net. And I know too, like, you know, everybody dealing with the evil Amazon and not, but
yeah. Well, the thing is also with books, I don't have a Kindle, and I buy books after books after books after books, and I've got thousands. And you know what? I'm of the belief that when I do lose the home I'm living in, I can just build my own home out of my books. I'm all right for the foreseeable future.
And when you do that, then you have another bizarro story.
Exactly. And it'll be a semi-autobiographical about this Brit with buck teeth and a papier-mâché home that will not survive at least one evening's worth of rain over here in our bloody island.
So you are, you know, books only. Is that sort of forcing you to get out there and try to do conventions and just signings or whatever?
Brighton is like how I assume. I haven't been to America as of yet, or Portland, where the hubbub of Bizarro is. But everyone I've spoken to, Lisa, Kevin, Garrett, everybody, the feeling I get from Portland is Brighton. We have festivals. We're very open-minded. We're very surreal. This is a home of artists. This is the home of bloody Nick Cave, the filmmaker Ben Wheatley, who I might add is a friend of mine.
Nice.
And just a hive of creativity. Not one person, not one select... like, it's not the home of just your Madonnas. It's your home of a Nick Cave, a Ben Wheatley, the director of Lawless. It's a place of artists, of poets, of musicians, of the macabre, of surrealism. And every event that I've been to, I've unofficially attended, because I always like to retain the sensibilities that NR encapsulates, though I haven't ever been there within that certain time frame when Stephen was running it on the streets of Utah, bombarding Mormons with his illicit controversial pamphlets, torturing them and scaring them away. I've recently, last year there was a fringe festival, and it's a long, long month's worth of marquees and teepees, open street, Shakespeare at the park. And I just stood on the corner of the street with a pile of books, handing it out. Just handed them out. But first of all, I needed to get a sense of the individual who was taking the book off me. And I didn't sell them because I didn't want to sell them. I just wanted to spread that creation. I wanted to spread that cult-like mentality. I don't expect people to go out their way to read something like Eat Your Keyboard and pay an extortionate amount and then get nothing from it. So get it for free, read it, don't like it, use it in your hearth, put it in the fire, or if you like it, it's hopefully expanded your perception of where literature can go. But what I've really been hoping to do is save enough money up so at the end of this year or come the beginning of next year, I can go down to Utah, meet my brother-in-arms, Stephen, the actual home of NR, where all of the work is done, and, you know, go out and do what he used to do when he was in a punk rock band, when he was out on the streets selling his wares, his hard-earned cash spent on these small, tiny little books that he's paid extortionate prices for people to either throw away or just to, you know, just, oh, it's a free book, and go out there with him and really push ourselves. That's what I'm really hoping for. I don't really think that we can expand much on this side yet. I think that our real home is within America, within those certain strict environments. But hey, who can say? Stephen could come this way and we could do the same here. But what we want to do is I want to go out and we want to go on a road trip. We want to meet all these different authors. We want to meet up with Jordan Crow. We would want to meet up with you. We'd want to go on a road trip and just share our creations and, you know, do events, do book events, see how the books do sell instead of us just handing them out for free.
I don't know. That's a very bohemian sort of a way to do things. Very different from typically what I hear. But I mean, the limited practice you've had doing that, have you gotten any feedback on those books you've just been out there handing around?
I have. I got a lovely message from a young lady who called me a misogynistic pig who needs to be burnt at the stake. That was lovely. Aww. She really engaged with my book in the way that I wanted. I loved it. I love that type of thing. And those who did read it, they said to me, oh, it's a little bit peculiar, but I see what you're going for. And then there was this one man, and he was the most evasive. I remember he was this big paunchy fellow, and he did have mutton chops, and he had that classical British air around him. And I handed him a copy of Id Cancer, which is Stephen's debut novella, and Eat Your Keyboard. Didn't say much. Lifted up his top lip in a sneer, nodded at me, walked away. And a couple of months ago, I got a message from him, and he really broke it down. He says, I'm not much of a social media person. I won't be spouting lyrical about it because I don't, you know, because we include our email addresses at the back of the book. But when I met him, I did say, hey, if you really want to personally tell me what you think, I gave him my email, and that was it. Mm-hmm. Book, email, he sodded off. And he got hold of me, and he said, I'm not going to beat around the bush. What the fuck is wrong with you? But also, he broke it down in one of the most marvelous ways. He knew it was a love letter to William S. Burroughs, the man, the god. It had the semblances of a dystopian world like J.G. Ballard. And he also admitted to me he was I think he was in the psychiatric field. He said, there's a lot of connotation in this, Zach, that really it tells me something about yourself. And he said to me quite pointedly, have you got mental deficiencies? Have you got something wrong with you? And I went, yes, I'm autistic on the lower spectrum of things. And to see that somebody, just by reading it, gorged that, he engaged with that on that level. He got it for what is interweaved with it. It was beautiful. And the same has happened with the reviewer copies I sent out. Bob Freeville, I believe,
right,
his name is. He wrote Battering the Stem. I sent him a copy out, and the review he gave me, he knocked it on the head. He understood what it was about and even opened up avenues of thought that I didn't even know the book was about itself. So anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. What you asked was, how have people's reactions been? As you would expect, if they want to approach me about it, half the time it's just a message request pops in my Facebook or on my email in the spam box, and it's usually, don't get it, nice images on the inside, oh, I'll leave a review when I can, and that's pretty much been it. But I find that Eat Your Keyboard has sold greater than I believe. I don't know the number, but it got enough money in so we could pay for the authors, the anthology and the illustrations, and that's good enough for me. Eat Your Keyboard's done its job. I was able to use that money to pay towards other artists to get recognized and read.
I'll tell you what, that whole story about the proper British gentleman who got back to you and basically said, this is not my cup of tea, but I get the book, I get what you're doing, and I get you. That's the type of thing that I would say, okay, I'm done now. Mission accomplished.
Yes.
I'm done writing.
Exactly.
That's what you're looking for.
Exactly. And isn't that everything a writer wants to do? I want you to understand me as a human through my work. And he did.
Yeah. That to me is like the ultimate satisfactory moment of being a writer. It seems like this is not something for him, but he understood exactly what I'm doing in a way that maybe people who enjoy my book still don't quite get.
Possibly. Well, with your work, it's you wouldn't really label it under bizarro or anything, but there's a familiar streak of that irrelevancy, but also because it is humorous, very humorous, I get it. And I think what really barricades people from enjoying it for what it is preconception and just narrowing your mind. Oh, it has to be this one thing. No, it doesn't have to be this one thing. This is a Mr. Frank book. You know what I mean?
It's like
that thing with a Guillermo del Toro movie, a film by Terry Gilliam. It's a book by Zac A. Ferguson. It's a book by Jordan Crowell. Hopefully you will get enough recognition that your name becomes synonymous with the work you do and what you mean within certain circles. And that's all you aim for. Like I said, even if one person read Eat Your Keyboard and got one satisfactory reaction from it, or got it, like I did with that gentleman. And what I loved about it, he was not spitballing. I'm not going to promote this book for you. It's not my cup of tea, but I can access those avenues of thought that you wanted me as a reader to access. And that's all I can ask for. Some form of engagement. Even if it is a young lady calling me a misogynistic pig, that's subjective. It's also something in that book has gotten on her nerves, something she didn't like, and I know what scene she was particularly referring to, because it can be viewed as misogynistic, it can be viewed as sexist, it can be viewed that a female as an object of desire, but what a writer writes most of the time isn't what a writer means or stands for. That's the divide with fiction, and a lot of people can't accept that, and that's why I love experimental writing, because you can really push your buttons. Like, I've got a 600-page experimental book called A Taste of Feeling coming out in the next 5 months, and it's probably one of my most hard-hitting, mentally draining, exhaustive, confounding, hard-hitting, controversial writes and reads that I've ever experienced. And, you know, that's what you want to do. You want to push people. You want to push them to their limits that they do extort a reaction. It's better to get a reaction from somebody rather than, shrug. Yeah, meh.
I agree. I agree 100%. That's sort of what we're all doing. Like you said, art shouldn't always be comfortable. A lot of times it should be uncomfortable. So I'm glad to hear that you're holding that up and disturbing people. Your end of the bargain as an artist. Unfortunately, Zach, we're coming to the end here of our wonderful time together.
Oh, no.
I know, right? Time flies when you're having fun always.
I've loved it. And the purring and the deep bass tones of your voice. Oh. Frank, I'm coming over to visit you.
Please do. Absolutely, please do. I'll be sitting right here waiting for you. And It would be a total treat to get to shake your hand in person and meet you. I enjoy what you're doing. Yeah, I mean, you're on my radar because you're out there doing those, you know, running Facebook Live just in the middle of the night and just and you're just talking it up and having a good time. But, you know, through that, you're making your presence known, and I see the work you're doing and the bigger picture. So maybe you're not out there digitally and marketing and everything, but you're a presence on social media, and for that, you know, you're getting noticed, and for that, I'm noticing that you're collecting wonderful work and doing wonderful work yourself. And I needed to bring you on and sort of spotlight that and hopefully make even more people aware of what you're doing.
Oh, thank you. That's so beautiful for you and so kind. Like, that's my engagement, just Facebook live videos, just who I am, what I am, what I stand for, and, you know, midnight musings, I call it. It's my midnight musings. It's better to talk to an audience of one rather to none.
Of course. Of course. And I always enjoy it. So when I see it out there, I will happily click on the button and see what Zach Ferguson is doing live right now on the Facebooks. Zongers, by all means, please. You know, it's only in print now, but if you have the means, pick up one of Zach's books. Strange Behavior sounds like a fantastic anthology. I can't wait to check it out myself. And I'm completely and totally intrigued with all your work, so I definitely want to check all that. I hope everybody has done the same well. Zach Ferguson, thank you very much for joining us on Bazong. And when you come out with more stuff and more things, and even if you visit this side of the pond, I'm going to be completely all over you to get you on Bazong again.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Frank. It's been a real honor and privilege.
The inimitable Mr. Zach Ferguson Zongers. What a wonderful guest. What a wonderful, spectacular human being Zach is. I implore you, I haven't personally checked out his books, but after that interview, no lie, I'm inspired to go check out what he's doing because he sounds like just such a wonderful, genuine person who really just wants to write fantastic stuff. So he's sold me, Zongers. He's sold me. Maybe he sold you too, Zongers. Check him out. Or, you know, if you have to wait till the digital comes out, he says he's going to get there. Either way, I mean, how can you just go on Amazon and look at that Strange Behaviors anthology, look at the lineup, and if that doesn't sell you in and of itself, I don't know what will, Zongers. I don't know what will. And Jim and Pazza, they have actually two covers for that anthology done by Jim Agpalza. And they're both spectacular. One's the main cover, one's the limited edition, limited to 100 copies. And they're both the same price. So a little enticement there. You can get for the price of the regular edition a limited 100 print run of an alternate cover by Jim Agpalza for Strange Behaviors anthology. I'd have no other idea how to sell it better than that, Zongers. So there we are. Hey, Zongers, speaking of anthologies, Project Entertainment Network also has an anthology out, loaded with stories by the various writers who also do podcasts here on the Project Entertainment Network. So that's something you might want to check out. It's easy. You can find that on Amazon as well. It's called My Favorite Story Podcast Anthology. Or you can go to projectentertainmentnetwork.com and go to their shop, and you'll find links to get the purchase of the book there, Zongers. Or find us out and about this summer at various locations where we will be out there selling the book as well. And there will be more information on Project Entertainment Network hosts' appearances coming up this summer. There will be a great many, including some for myself, Zongers. I like to get out and about there, sling some books and talk to the people, meet all the Zongers. It's probably my favorite thing to do is get out there and talk to the Zongers, meet the new ones, the ones I don't know exist, like Debbie Gibson and Dwayne The Rock Johnson from Bazong 100. Oh, Zongers, so, hey, like I said, we're going to keep doing this. We're going to slog on right to episode 200 nonstop. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you again next week on Bazong. But until then, you are free to go and listen to these other great Project Entertainment Network podcasts.
Watch out. There's a new terror taking over kitchens around the world. Thrills, chills, mad cooking skills.
It Cooks, a weekly podcast brimming with recipes, tips, food finds, seasonal specials, and guests galore. Hosted by horror author Amber Fallon, hey, that's me, a foodie with over 20 years experience cooking, baking, and generally making a nuisance of herself. You've watched Food Network, you've read cookbooks, but nothing can prepare you for It Cooks, coming to a device near you.
May I have your attention for the morning announcement? Please be advised the Lunch Ladies Book Club is coming to Project Entertainment Network. Join Shelley, Mimsy, and Ashley as they dish out a deep review of a book. Horror. Thrillers. Whatever they want to read and review. A blonde, a brunette, and a redhead walk into a bookstore and they're serving up hot book reviews. The Lunch Ladies Book Club, coming soon, exclusively on Project Entertainment Network. Would you now stand for the national anthem?
Don't get your lunch money stolen!
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.